sense of that phrase. What it is a glorified pause. The Israelis needed a pause for a number of reasons. This came down to the growing PR front, the European and Arab Initiative, which was launched at the United Nations General Assembly, whereby Saudi Arabia and France had put forth their New York Declaration on a Palestinian state, and a number of different diplomatic issues that they were facing. The United States saw this, presented a counterproposal, and also saw that the Israelis were failing to achieve their goals militarily on the ground, or at least their stated goals militarily on the ground through Gideon's Chariots 1, and then the second part to that operation, both of which proved to be failures. So Israel wanted to assess whether they could, during a pause period, implement new agendas to take over the Gaza Strip, to implement a plan of ethnic cleansing, and of course to defeat the Palestinian national resistance. This is something that they've failed to do so far. They will very likely fail to do it in the future.
The Israeli regime continues to violate the Gaza ceasefire agreement with Hamas, killing and injuring more Palestinian civilians, mostly women and children. According to the Palestinian Health Ministry, 5 children were killed in the latest strikes in Gaza. The new fatalities increased the number of Palestinians killed since the enforcement of the ceasefire to more than 390. Meanwhile, the regime's military vehicles opened fire on civilian homes in the Jabalia refugee camp in northern Gaza. Local sources noted that Israeli artillery also targeted the eastern areas of the cities of the city of Khan Yunis in southern Gaza. Earlier, the Israeli Navy abducted 4 Palestinian fishermen while they were fishing off the coast of Khan Yunis. The regime's forces then blew up their boat. According to Palestinian officials, the regime's navy has killed around 230 fishermen since the Gaza genocide started, while abducting around 30 others. The Israeli genocide in Gaza has killed nearly 70,670 civilians, mostly women and children. Our Gaza correspondent Moti Abu Musabbeh joined us earlier with the latest updates on Israel's ceasefire violations across the war-ravaged territory. Let's take a listen.
Let's begin from Khan Yunis city, which was under heavy bombings over the past couple of hours, whereas the Israeli warplanes launched another series of the strikes against the eastern sides of the city. Meanwhile, the western sides of the city were targeted by the Israeli naval forces. And in the meantime, the Israeli warplanes also launched another wave of the destructive and brutal attacks against the eastern side of Gaza city. We are still able to hear more massive bombings resulting from those constant and ceaseless attacks against those areas, particularly the eastern side of Khan Yunis city and Gaza city as well. In addition to that, the Israeli occupation forces continue their systematic policy of demolishing and detonating more residential buildings in those areas. This is why the situation on the ground is very precarious and dangerous, particularly for those Palestinians who are taking shelter near the so-called yellow line. They are still experiencing more bombings, more attacks, and they are still subject to more cruel attacks of the Israeli artillery as well, like what happened over the past couple of hours here in the eastern side of Al Buraj refugee camp in the central area of Gaza Strip, which was targeted heavily and extensively by the Israeli occupation forces. So today was another horrifying day for the Palestinian people. Needless to mention that the Israeli fighter drones are still flying intensely in several parts of Gaza Strip, and this is very ominous for the Palestinian people.
Meanwhile, Israeli forces press ahead with a months-long military aggression against Palestinian refugee camps in the occupied West Bank, injuring civilians and demolishing infrastructure. In one of the latest developments, the regime's forces issued a military order to demolish 25 Palestinian buildings in the Nor Shams refugee camp east of the city of Tulkarem. Palestinian officials condemn the move as an extension of the regime's systematic campaign of destruction and forced displacement of Palestinians in the refugee camps. They called Israel's new order a flagrant breach of international law, urging the international community to intervene. Meanwhile, tensions escalated in the city of Al-Khalil, where Israeli settlers staged a provocative march east of the city as the regime's forces closed several Palestinian neighborhoods. Local sources said the march began near the Kiryat Arba settlement. Israeli forces tightened restrictions around the old city of Al-Khalil and the Ibrahimi Mosque, further heightening tensions. We earlier talked to our West Bank correspondent Nekar Hamed to get the latest updates on the ongoing Israeli atrocities across the occupied territory.
Start from the city of Tul Kerem, where in this evening the Palestinians in Tul Kerem have received a military order stating about the demolishing of 25 new residential buildings in Nur Shams refugee camp to the east of Tul Kerem city. This is a part of the ongoing military aggression that has been going on for almost a year now on Tul Kerem and also on Jenin refugee camp. Of course, we have covered last week that the Israeli forces are making military infrastructure inside Nur Shams refugee camps, roads, and permanent military points inside Nur Shams refugee camp, which indicates that the initial or the main intentions for the Israeli regime is to keep their presence inside these refugee camps that has been fully occupied by the Israeli forces. This actually and unfortunately exacerbates the atrocities and the ongoing suffering of the Palestinians in the northern part of the West Bank. We're talking about almost 60,000 Palestinians who have been forcibly displaced from inside these three refugee camps, Jenin, Tul Kerem, and Nur Shams refugee camp.
Iran has strongly condemned the deadly terrorist attack in the Australian city of Sydney, which left over a dozen people dead and many others injured. Foreign Ministry spokesman Ismail Baghaei said, as a matter of principle, Iran condemns the violent attack against civilians in Sydney. He added that regardless of where they are committed, terror violence and mass killing shall be condemned. According to Australian officials, the attack was carried out by two gunmen, a 50-year-old father and his son. They opened fire at a Jewish event near Sydney's popular Bondi Beach, killing at least 15 people, including a child. One of the attackers was killed during the attack. Police said one gunman was a licensed firearms owner with six weapons registered to his name. Australian Prime Minister Anthony Albanese described the attack as a terrorist incident targeting Sydney's Jewish community. The shooting is the deadliest in Australia since the 1996 Port Arthur attack, which left 35 people dead. Author and journalist Robert Fantina was with us earlier to discuss the possible motives behind the terrorist attack in Australia. Here's what he had to tell us.
Australia, of course, has been a strong supporter of the Zionist regime since the genocide, before the genocide, but certainly since the genocide began in October 2023, and has not condemned Israel, the Israeli genocide at all. And unfortunately, the people that were victimized today at Bondi Beach were part of the, they might not have anything to do with it. However, there's so much hostility toward the Israeli government, the Israeli regime, that these sorts of attacks are going to occur. And it's tragic, and it's wrong, and it's unfortunate. But as long as the Israeli government continues its genocide against the people of Palestine and also the crimes it's committing against the people of Lebanon, Syria, Yemen, and so on, there's going to be this hostility. Now, that's unfortunately conflating anti-Semitism with anti-Zionism, which it's unfortunate when people do that, and it is the Israeli government that should be criticized and sanctioned in any way possible. As long as the Israeli government, which purports to represent Jewish people around the world, which it does not, but the government spokesmen say it does, then there's going to be more hostility, more of these kinds of attacks. They're tragic and they're wrong, but as you said, they're understandable in a sense because people are angry at the Israeli government.
A group of protesters have taken to the streets of New Orleans to condemn the arrests of undocumented immigrants by the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents. The arrested immigrants were reportedly working at a local factory. Protesters call for the immediate release and an end to the prosecution and arrest of immigrants. The arrests are the latest in a series of immigration enforcement raids across the country. Immigration arrests under President Donald Trump's administration have continued to rise, surpassing 30,000 per month. Critics say while Immigration and Customs Enforcement is detaining more people overall, its operations are increasingly focused on individuals with no criminal convictions. Earlier this year, major U.S. cities witnessed large-scale protests against the arrest and deportation of immigrants. In some cities, Trump sent National Guard units to help suppress the demonstrations. It's been 10 years since Nigerian security forces launched an attack on the worship center of the Islamic movement in Nigeria and killed hundreds of members and destroyed property. Danjuma Abdullahi filed us this report on the anniversary of the gruesome incident known as the Zaria Massacre.
This conference was one of the events organized to remember over 340 members of the Islamic movement who were murdered when soldiers of the Nigerian army attacked the home of Sheikh Ibrahim al-Zazaki and the worship center of the Islamic movement in December 2015. Participants at this conference described the 2015 Zaria massacre as a crime against humanity and of historic magnitude, which was committed by a few agents of the Nigerian state. Hundreds of men, women, and children were shot and buried in mass graves.
I lost 5 children, 3 of which are biological, 2 of which are adopted. They were orphans, and we took them in and were taking care of them. The 5 of them have not been found. Nothing about them were heard of. We just don't know how to explain the situation because of the excruciating pain in our hearts.
Mourners said that identity, faith, and religious conviction cannot be erased through violence. Speakers affirm that the Islamic movement is deeply rooted in an enduring struggle for justice and an unwavering resistance to tyranny, forces that cannot be silenced or extinguished.
The Zaria massacre made our call known to the whole world. Remember, in all continents of the world, there were demonstrations demanding our release. They knew what happened. Remember, in India, it went to the extent that the Prime Minister of India was saying that, why don't you release that Zaria?
A decade after the heinous massacre in Zaria, members of the Islamic movement continue to await justice and the prosecution of those responsible. Human rights organizations argue that the Nigerian government's attempt to conceal the atrocity reflects a profound disregard for human life and a blatant evasion of accountability.
We expected that indicted individuals and groups should be prosecuted. Particularly the military commanders who gave the order. We also expected government, having been given the names and identities of the victim, to take steps towards restitution and compensation. Nothing has been done.
Participants at this conference said tyrants don't realize that abuse of power weakens their own system. They explained that moral leadership endures as the era of every political actor eventually finishes. Ranjim Abdullahi, Abuja.
South Koreans have joined migrant workers from around the world in Seoul to protest the government crackdown and violation of migrants' rights. The demonstration follows the death of a Vietnamese migrant worker who lost her life in an immigration crackdown. The Iraqi government has officially announced the end of the UNAMI mission in the country after the visit of the general manager for the organization, Antonio Guterres, to Baghdad. The end of UNAMI's mission represents a transition to a new phase of balanced partnership with the UN based on respect for national sovereignty. There you have it. Those were the top stories. Thank you for being with us. Take care and bye-bye.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio presents
Viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another episode of the program Viewpoints with me, Atta, the host of this program. Shaykh Hussein and Sister Zainab are over here in today's discussion. Assalamu alaikum to both of you.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah and assalamu alaikum to your dear listeners.
Wa alaikum salam, brother, and to all the listeners.
So, here and there in the news networks and the social media, we hear about the coming attacks of the United States of America to Venezuela, which is not taking place yet, okay? It's only a threat. The U.S., fighters are over there, okay? Trump is every day threatening and does not answer, okay, whether to attack Venezuela or not. Now, the major question is that why Venezuela must be considered as a threat for U.S. Sister Zainab, let's start with you.
Okay, so where do I start? So obviously Venezuela itself is one of these, obviously for the U.S., especially for Trump, very threatening and must be so irritating and annoying to Trump, okay. A character such as Trump, because Venezuela, and I'm going to compare Venezuela to Iran and to China and to Russia.
Uh-huh.
So these are countries that do not bow to the U.S. Hegemony.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, these countries will be have already signaled in the what we call the multipolar world. And what is it about these sorts of countries? So these are countries that obviously will do their own thing.
Uh-huh.
And especially so Venezuela stands against this of U.S. hegemony is pro-Palestine. We know that under Maduro anyway.
Yes, Maduro.
And as is Iran. But the other thing is obviously these are hugely powerful countries. So Venezuela is very powerful. It has the world's largest oil reserves.
Okay.
It has the eighth largest natural gas reserves.
Wow.
And we've got this whole thing, the typical sort of U.S. meddling, threatening, sanctions, this sort of whole game playing out, which is almost, it's so predictable, it's almost boring. So what do? They sort of choose some sort of random and unimportant opposition leader.
Okay.
And what's the plan of this? Her name is Maria Corina Machado. She apparently, so her plan is, and you can see videos of her talking about just selling off Venezuela's resources, like $1.7 trillion of it.
Isn't it she lady that won the Nobel Prize, this peace Nobel?
That too.
Wow, okay.
And that also gives us
okay, hand in hand, yeah. Okay, that's
we
right.
know what's coming.
And we know that Trump was supposed to win the Nobel Prize, okay?
Yeah.
One of the candidates was him, okay?
He's very upset, actually.
Okay, he's very upset at why, okay. Okay, that's it. Go on.
Yeah, so, and then we've got this going on. So we know that Venezuela is very powerful, stands against the U.S. And the other thing with these countries, so when we look at Venezuela, obviously the U.S. Takes issue with Venezuela anyway.
Okay.
Because it is powerful and because it stands against it and because it's so rich in resources and everything.
Uh-huh.
Obviously, we know the Western hegemony wants to plunder.
Okay.
This is the old colonial mentality. It's not stopped. This is ongoing.
Right.
But the other thing is and obviously they'll be thinking, now if they hit Venezuela, if they can somehow harm Venezuela, cause it to just turn into a basket case like Syria, basically.
Mm.
They're also hitting one of their other sort of enemies because China is at the moment Venezuela's largest creditor one of its major destinations for oil. So obviously if they can interfere with hit Venezuela, that will also have impact on China.
Okay.
So these are all sort of linked together in a sense.
Okay.
Which
gotcha.
Is trying to destroy the big players in the multipolar world.
So it's not easy attacking Venezuela right now. So geographically speaking, it's close to the United States of America, okay? But ideologically, it's very much close to you, to China and Russia and Islamic Republic of Iran. So why Islamic Republic of Iran? I mean, this is a major question, okay? Nobody during the history of the world, when you go out and check out the references, will find ties between Venezuela or, for example, Cuba and Islamic Republic of Iran. Why is it so?
That's a good question, actually, but it hasn't been like that always.
All right.
In one sense, Venezuela is like Iran. What sense? In the sense that during Cold War, Venezuela was almost the only country in the Latin America that was anti-communist, mm-hmm. and it was the biggest American player in that region.
Okay.
Like Iran, mm-hmm. which before the revolution used to be American milking cow in the region. And when every Arab country sanctioned Israel for oil, this Mohammad Reza Pahlavi mm-hmm. gave oil to Israel. You see how much of an ally Iran was to America during the Cold War. And Venezuela was used to be like that, like Iran. But then there was a shift in the history. In Iran, it was through the revolution. In Venezuela, it was through the election of Chavez.
Okay.
So, and there's a reason for that. And the reason is that U.S. does not accept allies, dignified allies. U.S. Uh-huh. accept milking cows. Mm-hmm. Submissive servants.
All right.
Okay.
Okay.
And people start hating themselves, like nations start feeling that they have been disrespected. When you call a nation milking cow,
all right.
When you treat a nation like they realize generation after generation, these people are just plundering our resources and they are not contributing to the real development of this country. The thing that happened in Iran.
Yes.
So, if U.S. would engage, there's something...
That's why Mohammad Reza Pahlavi in the final year of his...
he got mad as well.
He got mad as well, yeah. Okay? That, okay, we are giving service to you, and now you are not doing anything to
us.
Okay.
He has started admitting it,
yes.
That after being a buddy for U.S., we don't have... we don't see any concrete or tangible results.
Yes.
It's still the same... dynamic is going on that they take our resources and they sell us their secondhand products. Anyways, so for the Venezuelan, I want to say that the reason that Venezuela shifted from being a U.S. proxy in Latin America,
yes,
in the Cold War, in the time of difficulty, the reason that they shifted to an anti-American nation mm-hmm. was U.S. treatment of these nations.
Okay.
That they downgrade these nations, they act in a... There's something called in international relations, it's called the engagement policy. Uh-huh. They don't apply engagement policy to treat them fairly, to give them real development.
Okay.
They create a facade of like the market for our goods and products like they do with the milking cows in our region. So they sell them, flood the country with American products, but they do not give them sustainable development. They do not give them factories. They do not give them industries.
And they are South America.
Yeah.
Okay.
So
have you ever watched the cartoon animation Up?
Yeah.
There are two kids, you know, showing the world map to each other. He said, this is America, but this is South America. I mean, okay, such an ideology in terms of we are North America,
yes,
so we are superior to South America.
You have always having the Latinos and the whites, so Latinos,
that's right.
Obviously.
Okay.
So after all these years of having a sense of shame and embarrassment, Venezuelan nation said, okay, let's have some agency and do something, and they brought Chavez into power,
mm-hmm.
and that started the U.S. hatred.
Oh.
Again, like a child that gets angry with someone.
Okay.
And instead of rethinking, what have I done with this ally mm-hmm. that they shifted against me, and instead of, after the Islamic Revolution, people in the U.S. would say, what did we do wrong with these people that they have shifted against us?
Okay.
The coup against Mossadegh and all the things that we did.
Yes.
Let's change course. Let's do some cooperation in the creation of human civilization. Instead of that, they say, okay, now they have turned into our enemies. Let's crush them.
Okay.
And this pushed Venezuela to create alliance with Russia, China, and Iran.
Yes.
Back to your question. Why Venezuela is friends with Iran?
Yes.
Because we have shared experience of being a U.S. ally, but he treated us in a miserable way, and we decided to have our own agency.
The revolution that took place in Iran 1979, how much do you think was rooted in the ideology of Latin American countries like Cuba, like Venezuela, or something like that?
The revolution of Iran, because it happened before the fall of Soviet Union, so people were still living in the bipolar world.
That's right.
After fall of the Soviet Union, U.S. got prominent position, like it was, and it has never been in human history an empire this powerful. So people were still waiting to see what happens to Iran. So it did not have immediate effect because there have been other revolutions that the U.S. had sabotaged and had changed. And that's why Imam Khomeini called the seize of the American embassy the second revolution, because the U.S. wanted to redirect Iranian revolution. So because this is a pattern that they do. They do not take involvement immediately. They just wait for the sentiment to be discharged. And then when the right time comes, they install somebody who is westernized, who is in line with their interest, and they redirect the whole thing.
That's right.
That's why they have two options. They have regime change, and they have behavior change. So they tried regime change Iran, they failed. They tried behavior change of Iran, they failed. And after that, these nations, independent nations, they realized, okay, it is possible.
That's right.
IRIB English Radio. Please follow our radio programs and podcasts on iranradio.ir.
Again, the same scenario as they called, I could remember George Bush called, for example, Iran and this and that, the axis of devil or something?
Evil,
that's right. So here they call, for example, Cuba, Nicaragua, and Venezuela as the axis of, we can say, that's right, authoritarianism.
You always have a sprinkle of democracy exporting, and we care about the dictatorship in this country as if their own allies are not dictatorship in our region. So it's not about democracy, but you always have this in the pretext that the Americans put forth for their intervention. Democracy is...
And the U.S. is really threatened that the message of revolution of Iran reaches South America, but North Americans want not. I mean, this is really, really strikingly shocking that, for example, how geographically speaking, for example, the message of your own people from the same continent will not reach you, but the messages from the other continent will reach you so far.
Yeah, well, obviously the propaganda started regarding Venezuela. It's been ongoing for a while. And then there's really crazy comments, absolutely, just incredible. So they took the typical things. Obviously, they're saying that there's Russian agents, Iranian agents in Venezuela, and that even Hamas and Hezbollah are operating in Venezuela.
What's the problem with that? I mean, being, for example, Iran's or Hamas agents being in Venezuela. What's the problem?
Well, for them, because they started the revolution or whatever the shift that they started, because they wanted to say that we have national agency. They labeling them in such a way.
With
a
foreign meddling.
To make them another problem.
Yeah, obviously, they've got, this is the one thing they want to take away from the fact that this is Venezuela's own. Well, at the moment, there's a response to the threats by Trump, obviously. There's huge rallies in the country ongoing, even though the sort of, this sort of opposition leader, this not very important person, because a Nobel Peace Prize means nothing these days anyway. But the interesting thing is, I was reading a comment by a sort of non-Venezuelan person who said that you had visited Venezuela maybe a couple of decades back, and was saying how, although, you know, and he obviously was not dealing with the normal people, like the middle, the huge middle class, or also the sort of the poorer class. He was obviously talking with the wealthy, the upper class, upper middle class, who seemed to be having a really good lifestyle. And he was sort of thinking, well, you know, and obviously we know that this is the other thing. If the US or the West wants to intervene, in any way do this, whatever is a soft war, or just somehow have a regime change from within a country, try and do this, they will target also the ones who are sort of maybe a bit more pro-West. And typically, these are the ones who really just want to enjoy, let's say, more stuff.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So they'll be quite happy to have their market, as you say, flooded with sort of US things and just increase their luxurious lifestyle. Because obviously the tendency is that they maybe don't care for what's happening to the rest of the population. That goes for any country.
Yes.
We have a bit of this sort of total indifference. But, you know, Maduro has huge popular support.
Yes.
And these the wealthy elite, just the wealthy class, yeah, they're the same everywhere.
Upper middle class.
That's
this
right.
is, again, in U.S. international relations, they invest a lot on upper middle class or higher than that in order to take their agenda along the way. So,
That's it. Sometimes I think to myself that historically speaking, South America is taking a revenge, a historical revenge from the white supremacy of the North America.
There is
the Native Americans, we can't say the land which belonged to them once, okay, is now being occupied by white supremacy. And now during the presidency of Trump, you know, this is becoming aggravated because he is... We can't say, how can I say, the model for white supremacy. Yeah, an icon of white supremacy.
Yes, it is. It somehow is true. The historical background is there, okay?
Okay.
The divide is there already.
Mm-hmm.
But again, some people would bring this up in order to say that these people are some fanatic. They are, because of some historical revenge, they're destroying themselves. More than that, I believe this is something that people like, and that is that they want independence. They want resources to be for themselves. And when it comes to the current president of the United States, he has such an impulsive personality.
Yeah.
He has said it time and again that peace through a strength. Have you heard this? He says that he wants, and he has this thing, to make a reckless impulsive move and then see the results. So if you ask about the future of what's going to happen in Venezuela-American relationship,
yes.
I don't see it very remote that Americans make a reckless move. Like, for example, especially learning from Zionists, if they want to apply one surgical operation, like surgical assassination, they may attempt to kill Maduro or whatever, things like that, in order to make the move, and then they see the result. If they don't see any pushback, they go forward.
They go forward.
This is the personality of Trump.
Yes.
And he said it in several times, like there's this very good book, War, that is about the personality of this guy. And he says that he believes in throwing a punch and then seeing what happens. And by that assessment, he comes forward.
Okay.
If you don't take the right measure against the first punch, then you're going to receive more punches along the way.
All right, that's it. As Ayatollah Khamenei in his visit to Maduro has said that to assume U.S. invincible is a major oversight, you know, okay? So, and this has always been, even Fidel Castro had a visit to Ayatollah Khamenei on that time, and they admired him and Ayatollah Khamenei as a role model for being anti-hegemonic, and we can say anti-Western hegemony in the West. And this is really, this must be outstanding for the people of the Muslim lands, that how non-Muslims rely on a Muslim figure over here to be the role model for them for anti-hegemony, okay?
Also, you see the pictures of Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah in Venezuela.
Yes.
They see these people, Sardar Soleimani, General Soleimani, they see these people.
Nelson Mandela had a visit also to Ayatollah Khamenei.
Yes.
He said, Nelson, so my leader,
Yeah.
In a video, Nelson Mandela calls Ayatollah Khamenei my leader, and this is really outstanding. Okay.
So because to keep a revolution on its track for 40 years in a world dominated by U.S. is very difficult.
Okay.
I mean, it has been proven to be impossible because U.S., what it does, it has redirect revolutions very easily.
Mm-hmm.
Look at Egypt. They said, okay, we want to have our country back. They toppled this person. The other person came. It's even worse than the previous one.
Mm-hmm.
So this is because of the leadership and the steering of this thing throughout all the ups and downs of the
international relations. That's why they see people who are leaders themselves, they realize the strategic significance of this.
Ayatollah Khamenei, in part of his speech, you know, in the visit to Maduro, says that in the past, when some Islamic countries decided to confront the Zionist regime by refusing to sell their oil, Westerners created uproar with the excuse that Islamic countries are making political use of the oil. However, today, in complete harmony with American policies, the same countries are using oil as a weapon in cooperation with some members of the OPEC and some countries in our region, which are harmed by these policies themselves.
Yeah, no surprise.
Mastery over the history of the world. May Allah safeguard our leader, all the freedom seekers all across the world, you know, and those justice seekers all across the world, whether Muslims or non-Muslims. Sheikh Hussein and Sister Zainab, thank you very much for a nice elaboration regarding what's happening in Venezuela. It was very kind of you.
Welcome.
Thank you very much for being with us with the program Viewpoints. If you have any question, if you want to visit more about our other programs, please visit our website at iranradio.ir. To another episode, God bless you all. Do not forget us in your supplications and du'as. Fi amanallah.
IRIB English Radio. Please follow our radio programs and podcasts on iranradio.ir.
I know that you could easily take away everything you've given me, and I try to remember not to take anything for granted, 'cause I know that one day suddenly this will all come to an end. So my last wish is for you to be pleased with me. I've trusted you a thousand times, but you always bring me back to the same place. My heart is moaning, but you can't hear. What do you care about me except my face? You think you know everything, you think you're enough, but sometimes a tiny virus ruins your life. You have so many heroes, but only in movies. I've tried all you said.
Welcome back to the Voice of War. My guest today is Professor Ilan Pape, one of the most prominent and provocative historians of the modern Middle East. He is the director of the European Center for Palestinian Studies at the University of Exeter and is best known for his groundbreaking work on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, including his books The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine and Lobbying for Zionism. His latest book, Israel on the Brink, offers a sobering diagnosis of what he sees as seven internal cracks threatening the future of the Israeli state, while also tracing the deeper historical, ideological, and geopolitical forces that have shaped its path. Ilan, thank you very much for joining me on The Voices of War.
It's a great pleasure to be on The Voice of War in the program. Thank you very much for having me. Great.
It's been a long time coming, so I'm very grateful that we finally be able to lock it in. You, as well as other prominent thinkers like Professor Mearsheimer, have drawn very strong links between AIPAC, the Zionist lobby writ large, Israeli politicians, along with US neocons, to push the agenda of initially, obviously, the Iraq War, but then subsequent wars as well. And many big thinkers actually attribute most of the wars in the Middle East over the past 25 or so years to this kind of same tension or the same push from the blending of the neocons with the Zionists. Can you just elaborate on that a little bit more?
Yeah, I take a bit somewhat different view on this in a way, and I think there's a difference between American imperialist impulses that the lobby is not responsible. I mean, that's the American, certain American way of thinking of what should be America's role in the world, and I don't think you can pin it on the lobby. With this I agree with Noam Chomsky, who says that this is the main push for American. After all, the Israeli lobby is not responsible for what the Americans did in the Philippines, in Southeast Asia, in Central America, South America. I mean, there is an American imperialist impulse, very yeah. strong one. It has nothing to do with the lobby. However, when it comes to Israel itself and the area around Israel, that's when the lobby is effective in convincing the American imperialists that American imperialist interests are best served through Israel. The Israelis are really panicking for what they saw yesterday on the White House. When President Trump says Saudi Arabia is as important to us as Israel, which is exactly what he said. He said they're as important as Israel. Israel is not more important than Saudi Arabia. This is a moment, you never know with Trump. I mean, you don't know if there's any substance behind his statement. But let's say it is a substantial statement. Let's say it's not even a whimsical kind of utterance, that it's part of a possible strategic idea of how America's world would look like, America's involvement in the Middle East would look like in the next decade or two. That means that the imperialist impulse is not based necessarily on a strong alliance with Israel. It's maybe based on a strong alliance with Arab states that are pro-Americans. It creates much less problem if you think about it. The Saudis, of course, nobody cares about civil rights and human rights records, but it's easier to overlook the violation of human rights, civil rights in Saudi Arabia. It's not easy to overlook the violations of the Palestinian rights by Israel. And that could be
well. It's one journalist.
Challenge.
One journalist that's really. Sorry to interrupt. There was one journalist, Jamal Khashoggi, that really draws some heat.
Yeah.
Between MBS and Trump in the recent press.
Absolutely. And America always say dictators are fine as long as they are our dictators. The point is that the lobby. If the lobby would face an America that says, yes, we still want to be a dominant power in the world and in your neighborhood in the Middle East, but you know what? We don't need you. Then the lobby would find it very difficult to be effective, I think.
Yeah.
So it's a cynical
yeah.
way of looking at the future by which you understand, and I always say it in the book, my last book, as an historian, the ability to relieve people from oppression and occupation is not always achieved by a pure, just moral struggle. Sometimes it is being achieved by more cynical development, for which you have very little, on which you have very little influence, but have impact on your life, whether you are, you know, you are enthusiastic about these changes or not. It doesn't matter. In the end of the day, it can create a different reality, similar to the impact of the end of the Cold War on the chances of toppling the apartheid regime in South Africa. It was a very important development, without which the apartheid would have lingered on for a while, if the Cold War would have not ended and the Soviet Union would have not collapsed.
So how do you see then the current situation in the U.S.? I mean, obviously with Trump, we don't really know what's going to happen next. But it's without a shadow of a doubt, I think the civil society, in fact his base, is hugely split. And the single issue that's splitting his base is Israel, you know, not least because of Gaza, but also the amount of money that U.S. sends to Israel. You know, many openly say that the U.S. is run by Israel because of these kind of blind loyalty to Netanyahu and his government, but also things like the assassination of Charlie Kirk. There's, you know, competing narratives, all of which somehow center around U.S. support for Israel or, you know, Mossad's influence in the U.S. And of course, probably the biggest one is Epstein, which, you know, of course there are issues and questions of who is guilty on both sides of the aisle in the U.S., but there's an overarching narrative there, especially now that we're hearing, as of today, that most likely we won't see the files released despite it passing House and Senate, and Trump will most likely sign it because of national security implications. And many are drawing, you know, some better than others, conclusions that the national security risk really is the expose of a foreign intelligence service, i.e. Mossad, having played a key part in, you know, the propping up of Epstein. How do you view that from your perspective?
Well, I think it's important to remember that the source of power for AIPAC is the Capitol Hill, not the White House. There were presidents that AIPAC didn't like. Jimmy Carter, Barack Obama, George Bush Sr., to mention the three most kind of, let's say, more courageous presidents, at least facing some of AIPAC's pressure. Even Reagan had a clash with AIPAC. So the source of power is not the White House. The source of power is Capitol Hill. Until we don't hear different voices from there, presidents come and go. The lobby in the Capitol Hill stays. You have to pay attention to Capitol Hill. That's where the source of power for AIPAC and the other sections of the lobby exist. So all these developments that you rightly describe, we need to see if they are reflected in the change of attitude in Capitol Hill, not in the White House. Now, I do believe that you're right, that a younger generation of Republicans would be much more isolationist in terms in the context of Israel, namely there would be a limit to how much money they think the United States should invest in sustaining Israeli policies and adventures. I think we should pay attention to the younger Democratic generation. They already have shown in the municipal elections last week their ability to even win in places which traditionally were kind of blue-collar people. Blue-collar workers were voting either for Trump. So I think, yes, that there is a trend in the society that would distances the United States from Israel. But I haven't seen yet its impact on Capitol Hill, you know, on the decision taken by either the House of Representatives or the Senate. But I do believe it will happen. I do believe that these are very slow processes. We have to remember that the lobby is still connected to the arms lobby, to the multinational corporation that still see Israel as a good investment for high tech, pharmaceutical technologies, and of course security and military industries. We should not underestimate the importance of these powerful lobbies to join forces with the lobby of Israel. But again, the question is, do these lobbies need Israel if indeed the Arab world is going to provide a much better and easier market or collaboration, you know? I think the bottom line of what we are talking is about is, A, not to take a determinist view on American policy. Also, historically, I can show that it was not always, as people think, totally anti-Palestinian and pro-Israeli. So let's not take a determinist view on it. Secondly, there are all kinds of possible scenarios, one through a more progressive democratic success, one through maybe less attractive to me, but a more isolationist Republican success. Either way, it's part of the same, you know, metrics of processes that lead us to think that the position of Israel becomes much more vulnerable and precarious as we look into a more distant future. Mm.
So do you place the recent purchase of things like TikTok and the, you know, installation of prominent Zionists in, you know, CBS News, in the U.S., do you see that as part of that tactic to try and reassert itself amongst the younger audiences? Because I think that's where they've really lost the support.
Yeah, and it won't work. They will fail. Because TikTok, in the end of the day, is a means to a goal. It's not the goal itself. It's just a vehicle, and the passengers determine the direction of the trip, not the manufacturer of the car, so to speak. So I don't think it will work. I think this is like the tough legislation against BDS. All that is a fight back. Of course, they're fighting back for their power. I don't think they even fight back anymore for Israel. I think that's what I write in the book. I said that the lobby became a powerful organization that seeks power for the sake of power. I don't think they're even working for Israel anymore. They enjoy decades and decades of being so powerful, they don't want to lose it. And that's why, by the way, as I show in the book, a more conscientious members of AIPA in the early 1990s began to leave the organization because they felt that this is not working for Israel, that this was working for the lobby itself. So I really don't, it's very difficult to convince people because they seem so powerful, they buy this and they buy that, and they dominate this organization, the other. Yes, this is the last battle, and it's a fierce battle. But I do believe it's doomed to fail. Like so many acts in history where things that the campaigns based on populism, coercion, power, for a while are very successful because they intimidate, they terrify people, and they destroy. So it's easier to destroy than to build. In the long run, they're not sustainable. And we have to believe that they're not sustainable.
Yeah.
Otherwise, the whole human society, the whole globe is in danger if these things are sustainable for life. Yeah.
I think that speaks to the point from your recent interview with Mehdi Hassan, that history is not history is cyclical rather than linear. And I think as a historian, I think we should heed that. But can you just unpack that a little bit more? What do you mean by history is cyclical rather than linear?
Yeah, I mean that we were there before, not in the same way, but we were there before in ages, in an age where populism, cynical politics, expansionist empires, political and economic elite that disregarded the main concerns of their societies. We were there before, and they fell. They fell when eventually people had enough and created a different kind of politics. And this will return. And you can already see it. You know, when millions of people demonstrate for Palestine in the last 2 years, they don't only demonstrate for Palestine. they demonstrate for different kind of politics in their own country, because there is a connection in their eyes for the immoral position on Palestine and the immoral position on ecological justice, poverty, immigration, you know, all the things that they realize two things, and you can see it from the discourse and the impulse that brings them to the kind of the center of the city, if you want to demonstrate. One is that not one country can solve the real issues that face the world, whether it's global warming, poverty, wars, and so on. This is not something one state or even an empire can take upon itself. You need global cooperation. And for global cooperation, you need the global justice system, which we don't have, and hopefully we will have. And Gaza proved that we don't have a universal international justice. So that's the first thing. The second thing, that they see the connection between the lack of interest of their politicians in the issues that I just mentioned, the other injustices, and their immoral position on Palestine. And I think that creates in me the hope that, because I do believe that the issues are much bigger than Palestine and concern everyone on the globe, I have to believe that humanity has the power to go back again, as it did again and again in history, and, you know, try at least to open a different chapter in the relation between what we do and the fate of our globe, our ecology, our societies, and not only base our politics on self-interest with very little care for other people, their aspiration, and the quality of life.
Just on that point, you've in your book Israel on the Brink, you actually, towards the end, you take up an issue with capitalism, which I just wanted to build on a little bit. I recently interviewed a prominent Balkan security analyst, Zlatko Hadžidejić,
yes,
who's built his career on the link between capitalism and nationalism. You know, builds on the thinking of thinkers like Gellner and Anderson, the Imagine Communities.
Yeah.
He builds on their thinking that nationalism and capitalism are very closely intertwined. And his prediction, at least given the current state of affairs, is that in our hyper-capitalized world, we require authoritarianism. I wonder how that sits with you, and whether you see some links between what you're saying, especially given what you've talked about the economic troubles that are that Israel faces, but of course, much of the world, especially the West, faces anyway.
Yeah, I do think that, capitalism has many versions. Not lump them all together, but I think the kind of capitalism,
of course,
that is evolving
of today,
recently, is very much based on this idea that economic interests of the few and not of the many are the compass that leads to decision taken, whether to support Israel, whether to invest in Gaza, whether to invest in global warming or in fossilized energy. You know, all these decisions are driven by the question of profit, not by question of the welfare or even the survival and sustainability of the globe, which is incredible. So yes, now, because you can see the direct connection here, as I said before, to change that kind of attitude, you need a global cooperation. Nationalism usually is one of the most important impediments for global cooperation. So nationalism says, I don't care about the situation of the water, the quality of the air in the neighboring country. I don't care about the violation of human rights, civil rights in Palestine, 3,000 kilometers far away from where I live. All I care, and I may even be do something about these things in my own country in the name of nationalism. But that would be ineffective. It would have no impact, even if there is a genuine wish among capitalists to solve some of these problems. They cannot do it because they are so tied in with nationalism. Absolutely, and I think the role of the left is to bring back the idea of universalism.